Good afternoon and welcome to Division 1 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases on the docket this afternoon. The first is People v. Edwards and the second is Cleland v. Azure Solutions. Are counsel present and ready for the Edwards case? And are counsel present and ready for the Cleland v. Azure Solutions case?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. We'll obviously proceed in the order which they're shown on the docket with the Edwards case first. I'm sure counsel are familiar with our procedures. I just want to remind counsel and members of the audience about a couple of our rules. First of all, if you have any cell phones or electronic devices that make noise, please turn them off so that they don't disrupt the argument this afternoon. We'd appreciate that. Also, as you know, we have 15 minutes per side. Appellants, if you desire to reserve time, you can certainly attempt to do so. I will attempt to remind you when that time is approaching. If you indicate at the beginning of your argument that you intend to reserve a particular amount of time, but whether you have that time, of course, will depend upon how the argument goes and our questions and that sort of thing. Do the parties have any questions? Okay, then we're ready to proceed with People v. Edwards.
May it please the court, my name is Sean Thompson, number 40067, here on behalf of defendant appellant Joseph Edwards. The issues I have raised in the briefs regard the trial court's improper admission of identifications that were primarily based on impermissibly suggestive procedures and the court's improper statements during voir dire, which lowered the prosecution's burden of proof, refuted the presumption of innocence, aligned the court with the prosecution, and bolstered the prosecution's case. Both of these errors significantly impacted the same aspect of the trial to Mr. Edwards' prejudice. Both errors severely undermined his defense of mistaken identity. I intend to focus today mainly on the impropriety of the court's comments to the jury, but I'm happy to discuss the photo array as well. I've distributed copies of that array to opposing counsel in the court in case there's time to discuss that issue. Prior to the presentation of any evidence at trial, the court told the jury several things it believed about the case. In a colloquy, the court assured the jury that Mr. Edwards, quote, did something to cause the charges against him, and that the question of whether or not he did something was not an issue for the jury. It told the jurors they need only consider whether what Mr. Edwards did was the crime he was charged with, and the court concluded its thought by stating, and if he did something, well, he may not be innocent in the classic sense. Mr. Edwards' entire defense was that he had been misidentified, and that he did not do anything to cause the charges against him, and that he was, in fact, innocent in the classic sense. The court's statements directly refuted Mr. Edwards' defense and violated his rights to a fair trial, as they deprived him of the presumption of innocence, proof of each element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt, and a fair and impartial tribunal.
I just need to interrupt you to clarify something in the record. Our record indicates that the judge said he may not be guilty in the classic sense. You just said innocent.
My record says innocent in the classic sense.
Okay, we'll look at the record and clarify that.
The record citation is from volume 6, page 34 is where he says that. Sure. By assuring the jury that Mr. Edwards did something that might make him not innocent in the classic sense, the court deprived Mr. Edwards of his right to a presumption of innocence. A trial that commences absent this essential presumption that the defendant is indeed innocent in the classic sense is structurally flawed and requires reversal.
No objection to the judge's statements and no motion for a mistrial, correct?
That is correct.
So we're just here for plain error review.
I believe it's a structural error.
You're going to say structural error review. Okay,
yes.
I cut you off. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I'm basing that on Sullivan v. Louisiana and this court's precedent and Banziger. And I have a citation there if you require it. Given the court's express statement that directly refuted the possibility that Mr. Edwards was innocent, it's impossible the jury fully gave Mr. Edwards a presumption of innocence throughout the trial. Further, the court's comments also lessened the prosecution's burden of proof and deprived Mr. Edwards of his right to proof of each element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Was any error corrected by the instructions that were given to the jury? I mean,
at the end of trial, Your Honor?
Yeah, they were told that the presumption of innocence was with the defendant. They were told that the charges against the defendant are not evidence. They were told the burden of proof remains with the prosecution.
The jury was instructed at the end of trial, but the trial proceeded within a framework where they were not apprised of these essential protections that the defendant enjoys during the trial. The jury heard the evidence and sort of internalized the evidence without these presumptions, and may have in fact been thinking he was not innocent the entire time through trial, and that was only corrected at the very end, right immediately before they went into deliberations.
I guess that's my question. Was it corrected at the end? Do those kinds of instructions take care of the...
That doesn't take care of structural error, because structural error is something that infects the trial process. If you don't advise the jury, or you misadvise the jury or completely refute these ideas to the jury prior to trial, and then the trial commences under that structural defect, later attempting to re-advise the jury or advise them correctly won't change the fact that the whole trial took place in absence of these protections.
Mr. Thompson, yes. Would you agree that we need to consider the comments that you're speaking about in the context of the entire comments of the court, specifically the hypothetical that preceded? And by the way, I appreciate you providing that in your brief.
Well, I believe that the problem with the court's comments is that the comments I'm complaining of are the conclusion of the court's explication of that hypothetical. In the court's hypothetical, the person who pays for gas but doesn't collect a receipt actually would be innocent in the classic sense. Here, the court concluded this hypothetical by saying Mr. Edwards was in a different position and that he was not innocent in the classic sense. And so I think that you can look at all of the court's comments in context of one another, but it's important to remember that these are conclusions that the court is itself drawing from its hypothetical and conveying to the jury.
Wasn't, though, the hypothetical consistent with the defense theory of defense, which was, yes, I was there. I had been there a couple of days or a few days earlier, but it's simply a misidentification. I wasn't there later, like the driver in the hypothetical who didn't take the receipt.
But see, that is where the court's hypothetical breaks down as applied to Mr. Edwards, given its conclusion that Mr. Edwards did something which might not make him innocent in the classic sense. If indeed the court was allowing for Mr. Edwards' defense, and that simply by being in the store, he did something prior, you know, on the 4 days prior to the robbery, he did something, that would not make him anything but innocent in the classic sense. By saying that he did something which made him not innocent in the classic sense, he's really refuting the idea that all Mr. Edwards did was make an appearance at the same store 4 days prior. So, given the conclusion that the court draws and conveys to the jury, I don't think that the fact that if different conclusions were drawn from the from that hypothetical, we might not have the same problems that we're seeing in this case.
Mr. Thompson, on what basis do you contend that Sullivan v. Louisiana and Basinger dictate that this should be structural rather than plain error?
Looking to Basinger, the court says that the reasonable doubt standard is the means by which the presumption of innocence is implemented. Basically, when you have an omission in instructions or a misinstruction improperly advises the jury about the contours of those ideas, that's structural error. And that extends to both the presumption of innocence and the reasonable doubt standard. If the jury is operating under a mistaken impression of what those mean or where they apply, the court has seen that as structural error. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Was the jury here, after it was selected, instructed in any way on the presumption of innocence?
I don't believe that occurred until the written jury instructions were submitted to them at the end of trial.
Did counsel's opening statements make assumption of innocence prevailed?
I don't recall that it did, Your Honor. The court's comments also improperly aligned it with the prosecution and bolstered the prosecution's case, and this would be reviewed under the plain error standard. Interspersed with other comments, the court stated to the jury, quote, "We didn't go out onto the street or go out into that long line this morning, pick him, Mr. Edwards, out of the line, bring him up here, sit him down, and say, hey, by the way, we've got some charges we want you to answer for. I'm sorry, answer to." By its repeated use of the pronoun we, the court rhetorically included itself among those who brought the charges against Mr. Edwards, and by doing so, implicitly endorsed the validity of those charges. The court assured the jury that it and the prosecution had selected Mr. Edwards for prosecution with good cause, that he was not just pulled off the street or out of a line. These statements constitute plain error. It's clearly erroneous to make such statements. The ABA Standards for Criminal Justice caution judges to be exceedingly careful to avoid appearance of favoring one side over the other. And this is because such appearances carry great potential to sway the jury and affect the outcome of the case. It's understood that juries hang on judges' words, and if they're able to discern the judge's view of the evidence or the case in general, they're likely to follow it. The court's comments revealed its thoughts on the case. From the court's comments that they didn't just pick out Mr. Edwards from a line and that he may not be innocent in the classic sense, a jury would glean that the court, with its greater knowledge of the evidence, had reached the conclusion that Mr. Edwards was guilty, or at least that the court leaned in that direction. Mr. Edwards has a due process right to an impartial tribunal, and the court's comments precluded the possibility that the tribunal could be impartial towards him. The comments were manifestly erroneous and likely affected the outcome of the trial. They were plain error that requires reversal. Unless there's any other questions, I'd like to reserve this.
Said the last thing the judge said was he did something, but according to the transcript that's in front of us, the last thing the judge said was, the issue is whether he committed the crimes that the district attorney has charged him with. Now, you don't have a problem with that statement, do you? If the judge had said only that, he would.
I do in the context of the rest of the statements, where the judge is saying that it's assured that Mr. Edwards did something, and now we just need to decide what it is. What is the definition of what he did? That becomes basically guilty of what crime, not is he guilty.
So the issue is whether he committed the crimes that the district attorney has charged him with. That doesn't save the comments. Isn't that an appropriate statement to say that to the jury?
If it was in some other context, it might be. But under the facts that the court denied the possibility that Mr. Edwards might be factually innocent, I don't think that statement saves his earlier comments. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court, John Lee on behalf of people, bar number 38141. As the questions, I think, reveal, our submission on the voir dire issue is pretty straightforward. The judge's comments were a correct instruction on the law, designed for the defense benefit, and interpreted as such. On the first comment that we're dealing with,
I want to go right to this one statement that the defense relying on primarily. He may not be innocent in the classic sense. What does that mean?
When we take it in context, I think with the rest of the hypothetical, is maybe he did something that the jury wouldn't approve of. But that's not the question in this case.
My problem is, under the record here, what could that possibly be? I mean, in the hypothetical, the driver who didn't take your receipt didn't do anything wrong in any sense at all, anything that somebody would disapprove of. So that doesn't really match up with the statement that he may not be innocent in the classic sense. And I don't think it really matches up with the evidence that's presented either, because the evidence that's presented was he was simply in the store a few days earlier, which, of course, there was nothing wrong with that. So what could he have been not innocent of? What could he have been guilty of other than the crimes charged, if that wasn't what the court was referring to?
Well, a couple of reactions. I guess first, I don't know if we need to actually decipher what the judge meant when we take all this comments in context and we consider the curative statements, I think, that preceded and followed that statement. As to answer your question directly, just off the top of my head, I mean, maybe the judge thought that maybe some members of the jury would be concerned that where the defendant was. It just wasn't that he was at a store. He was at a particular store. But I mean, again, that's all speculation. That's something I don't think we necessarily need to go into.
Well, Mr. Lee, what about the statements that the judge made that the defendant must have done something? And not only that, but the judges like it when jurors think that the defendant must have done something. Well, why is that a correct statement of the law?
I think it is when you take it in context. I mean, again, this preceded that long hypothetical of every moment in your life you're doing something. Someone can end up in the defendant's chair just because they did something completely innocent. And if we read the line that directly follows, I think, the statement at issue, it's, well, let me read the first one. So, and if he did something, well, he might not have been innocent in the classic sense, but that's not the issue. The issue is whether he committed the crimes that the district attorney has charged him with. So when you hear the evidence, if they can prove that he did what he's charged with beyond reasonable doubt to your satisfaction, you find him guilty. If they don't prove it, doesn't matter what he did, he's not guilty.
How does that put in context the statement that the defendant must have done something?
Everyone does something at any given point. And I mean, however artful that comment may have been, I think taken in context, that's all it was meant to convey, and that's the likely interpretation that the jury got.
Can you tell us a possible innocent explanation of that comment?
I think the whole point, the innocent explanation, is you're just trying to describe to the jury the importance of finding the defendant guilty of the charged crime, nothing else. Regardless of what he may have done or not done, the only issue before the jury was whether he did the crime charged, and if he did so beyond reasonable doubt. Anything else the jury was not to consider, and if they didn't find that, then they had to render a verdict of acquittal. So that, along with, as the court pointed out, the jury instructions at the end. Again, the jury was reminded both, I think, at the beginning, before this whole hypothetical, about the presumption of innocence, and again in the jury instructions, which the law is well settled that we presume that the jury followed the instructions. I just don't think that there's enough here to say that the jury was misinstructed on the presumption of innocence.
What about the statement using the word we? We didn't just go down and pick him out of the line of people waiting outside the courthouse.
And again, I can see the court's apprehension of the term we, but again, that's still not really tied to anything that's actually directly refuting the defense presumption of innocence. Again, when it's tied with the fact that he's sitting in the chair, here's a long hypothetical of how someone completely innocent can end up sitting in the chair. So it's not tied, although they use the term we, it's not tied to the court's putting its weight that the defendant is guilty of the crime. And that's really the only concern that the defendant's raising here, is that the court somehow affiliate itself with the people that the defendant did the crime charged. And if you look at the instruction as a whole, I mean, that's all it's really explaining, and that's why none of these little errors ever went to it. All the court was saying is the only thing the jury needs to look at is whether the defendant committed the crime charged. And it's got to be beyond reasonable doubt. If the people don't prove that, you acquit him. All the other stuff is collateral, not to be considered, not to affect their judgment. For example, so the fact that we put him in that chair, it doesn't matter. You don't consider that. So I think in that way, it does not refute the defense presumption of innocence.
Don't you think that statement allies the district court judge with the prosecutors or police officers when the judge used the word we?
I think that's a very strange interpretation considering the long, long discussion they had.
Well, then to whom does the word we apply in your view?
It could be interpreted to apply to the court and the prosecutor. I mean, I will grant that. But to the extent, did it imply that we put him in the chair and therefore you need to find him guilty? Or we put him in that chair and therefore you should presume him guilty? Taken as a whole, I just don't think we can get there at all.
What I'm asking you is as a grammatical question, to whom else might the word we apply if it doesn't apply to the judge and the prosecutors or police officers? Is there an alternative interpretation that you can offer?
There's not. I mean, I guess I could say it's more general that the we wasn't designed to align to just the prosecution, that, you know, we as a unit didn't put him in that chair for nothing. But I can see how it could be interpreted as being aligning itself more closely with the prosecution. But I still think the fatal flaw to that argument is it still doesn't go to whether or not the court gave the jury the impression that they thought the defendant was guilty or that they were refuting the defendant's presumption of innocence, especially when they explicitly instructed the jury time and time again that the defendant was presumed innocent.
What is your response to Mr. Thompson's argument that when the judge said the defendant must have done something, that was particularly concerning in a case where the only issue was identity?
If anything, I think it inured to his benefit. I think it's completely consistent with his theory. That advising the jury that although the defendant could have been doing something, that doesn't mean he committed the crime. I think that's actually inures to his benefit when you're pursuing a mistaken identity. And turning that to defense counsel's argument that structural error applies, because I think it's very important to remember that the defendant never tendered an objection. He never asked for a mistrial, which generally means that we presume that it wasn't overly damaging. But with that said, the fact that their argument that the error is structural because of defense theory, I think that actually weighs against any claim that it is structural error. Generally speaking, structural error applies only to an error that's independent from the trial itself. It so infects any trial that that's why we can't review it. But anytime you look as an as-applied analysis, you're pretty much conceding that it can be reviewed within the framework of trial. So therefore, structural error would not apply. Additionally, as far on the error requirement, I don't think there's any cases ever said that something similar to here amounts to the level of structural error. I mean, in the finite level of cases where they found structural error, I don't think this fits anywhere near it. If the court has no further questions.
I have some about the identification, although I know counsel didn't argue that.
Yes.
Was the videotape that was viewed by the clerk, or did the evidence at the motions hearing indicate that the videotape that was reviewed by the clerk of the defendant's appearance in the store a few days before, was that used by the detective? How was that used by the detective to identify the defendant? In other words, once the clerk said, oh, this is the guy who I thought was in the store, which I gather is what he said, how did that tie into Mr. Edwards?
A couple of points. At the outset, I think just reviewing as a general parameter, we've only looked at the suppression evidence in evaluating that claim. And as far as the suppression testimony goes, I don't think the deputy actually used the tape. So what happened was the witness, when he's first approached by the deputy, the witness said, I know the defendant. I saw him a few days earlier. He went and got the surveillance tape. A different detective 4 days later, I think it was based on a Crime Stopper tip. They had the defendant in custody and then included in the lineup as a different detective. So I don't think the detective actually relied on the tape.
There was no connection between those two events. The guy's picture did not get in the array because the clerk saw him on the tape. It was just bolstered his identification of him.
I don't think so. I don't think it's possible that it could have been, but I don't think there's an express statement at the suppression hearing. It's, of course, possible that they also had that and that's why they put him in, but there's no express demarcation to that. Are there any other questions on the ID testimony? If not, I'd ask this court to affirm. Thank you for your attention.
Mr. Thompson, you have 3 minutes and 45 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Richmond, just to follow up on your questions about the ID, actually, Deputy Cortez watched the video of the surveillance video from earlier in the week with the witness, and it's unclear what picture was used on television, but a picture was displayed on television that led to a person calling in.
I think it may have been from that earlier surveillance videotape.
It's not clear from the record, but it seems like that's where they got the first information about a photograph of Mr. Edwards. So it's very possible. And regarding how that all weighs in, what happened was the deputy sat and watched the tape with Mr. Hicks, who then looked at a picture of what was admittedly Mr. Edwards for an unspecified period of time. This was all adduced at the suppression hearing, at least the fact that he sat with with the witness and watched the video.
What did he say? I think this is the guy who robbed the store?
I believe that's correct.
Today?
Yes. But what happened was then later, after they got the photograph, the mugshot of Mr. Edwards, they put it in a lineup where he is admittedly the only person who could be conceived of as African-American in a field of five people who appear to be of Hispanic descent. And the court actually waved away that distinctive aspect of the photographs by saying all of them could be perceived as Hispanic.
Just to clarify, the photograph in the lineup in Exhibit 13 is not a photograph from the surveillance videotape.
No, it is not.
They got it from someplace else.
That is a different mugshot. Right.
So the detective made some connection between seeing him on the videotape, and he found this mugshot or whatever it is in a book somewhere or a file somewhere.
Based on the Crime Stopper tip, Mr. Edwards came to the attention of the police, who then sought him out. But the court actually said that Mr. Edwards was the only person who could be seen as an African American, but waved it away saying that all of them could be seen as Hispanic. The problem is that the witness stated that a light-skinned black male was the person who robbed him. And the court actually, like I said, the court actually found that Mr. Edwards was the only person who could be seen as a African American. That's on in volume 5 on page 104, I believe. So given that he is the only person matching the racial description given by the witness, and the fact that he has a bright orange top that distinguishes him from the rest by his manner of dress, this looks very similar to what occurred in Bernal, where the defendant was distinguished by his race and by the background of his photograph, which was different than the rest, indicating that that photograph had been taken or had been selected rather than just as part of going through a book of mugshots or something of that nature.
I guess my problem is when he saw the guy's photograph on the surveillance videotape the day of the incident, he said, "Oh, that's the guy that robbed the store." Well, when he saw him a few days later, he said, "Oh, yeah, there's the guy again."
Well, I think that
I don't see how it's so suggestive, actually.
Well, maybe I would say that the showing the videotape is sort of akin to a show-up identification, where the police show one photograph or bring the suspect and display them to the person. But this wasn't video, or this wasn't something that came from the actual time of the offense. It was him in the store, and it looked very similar. And Mr. Hicks's identification was not as certain as he seemed. He actually said later that the person in the video still was, I think he said, darker, bulkier, and taller than the person who robbed him, and said, "That's not the person who robbed me," on the stand at trial. So the question, the idea that he immediately went upon Mr. Edwards as the robber is not all that clear.
Thompson, your time is up.
I see. I'd ask the court to find that there's been structural error or harmful error here and reverse Mr. Edwards' conviction of robbery.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. We'll take